It's been a wonderful few days that we've had together. I've been here before. I think one time I had a weekend meeting a number of years ago, and one other visit, I think, in the past. But it seems like this time, spending a number of days with you, I've been able to get a better sense of the warmth and the service of the congregation. And I'm impressed, and I'm blessed to kind of be a part of the family as you support me in my work. And now I feel like I know you better, and hope you know me a little better. And we'll keep working together and praying together, and I am full of gratitude for what you've done. I admire the things. I admire the service that you give here to all people. I admire the service you give to those who are hearing impaired. And I like to watch the interpretation. I do a different kind of interpretation. Every Sunday I'm interpreting either from Spanish to English or English to Spanish. And I know it's a different kind of thing, but still it's similar. So I thank you all for that service. And for those of you who are here taking advantage of that service, may God bless you all. Bless all of us. What is the greatest enemy that God's people face today? The thing that's most likely to cause us to drift away from God. Well, if I were to ask everyone here to take a note card and write down what, in your opinion, were the three greatest dangers facing God's people, I think I would get a lot of different answers. I have a feeling that men would tend to answer one way. Women might tend to answer another way as to what are our greatest enemies. I know there would be generational differences. Those of us who are 50 years in age and up would probably have quite a different list from those who will say 30 years and under. I guess those between 30 and 50 are in the donut hell or whatever. But there would be different types of answers that we would give. I want us to think tonight of spiritual enemies. Four facts about spiritual enemies. And I hope by the end of it we'll have a healthier concept of how to deal with them. First of all, we had better realize that we have them. Talked earlier in the week about postmodernism. That's the worldview that most affects our culture today. And the only thing that's wrong in that way of thinking is to say that something's wrong. And it's kind of considered to be cool not to be upset by evil, in particular religious evil. And if you were to ask most people today, how big of a problem do you think sin is in the world? I think most of them would laugh at you. But here's the problem. If we have no spiritual enemies, we have no love. If you love life, you're going to hate death. If you love justice, you're going to hate injustice. And if you're going to love God, you're going to hate what is evil. If you don't hate anything, then you don't love anything. There are some texts that we often give to make this point. You that love the Lord, hate evil. Psalm 97:10. Notice the proximity of love. Love the Lord, hate evil. If you love something, you're going to hate what opposes it. Psalm 119:104. Through your precepts I get understanding, therefore I hate every false way. An English writer, I admire him because he was born in Poland. English was not his first language. Joseph Conrad said, "You shall judge a man by his foes as well as by his friends." So we have foes. Jesus put it this way: "Woe to you when all men speak well of you." In other words, woe to you when you have no enemies. Jesus had enemies. The religious establishment of his day, they were enemies of Jesus. Ignorance, lack of faith. And if we're followers of Jesus, we'll all have them. And sometimes we'll have, well, we should always have the same enemies that Jesus had. If you look at the prophets of the Old Testament, just all of them were very strongly against something. And of course, they were against what opposed the way of God. So, that's the first point. You need to recognize them. And don't think this is going to be a 10-minute sermon. The other points are going to take a little longer than the first one. But let's go now to the second. Different enemies threaten more at different stages of life. The scriptures teach this. 2 Timothy chapter 2, 22. Flee youthful lust. Some lust are stronger for youth. They affect youth more than those who are more mature. In Titus chapter 2, Paul seems to focus on different spiritual challenges faced by different groups of people. And if you look at the concerns that Paul had for them, you can almost sense that he's picking out some that are of particular danger to each group. For example, older men, sound in love and in patience. You know, old men can be grouchy. Now, I wouldn't know anything about that, but that's what they say. And so, don't be grouchy. Be sound in love and patience. Older women, one thing is said about them, not given too much wine. And of course, I don't think that might be a big problem with us, but sometimes with all the aches and pains of old age, and it's not just women, but I think that's where often we see the most abuse of prescription medication. Sometimes it's necessary to take care of pain, but sometimes there can be an overdependence on that. Younger men are especially encouraged to have sound speech that cannot be condemned. Who is it that's most tempted to repeat a questionable joke or maybe to repeat some words they've heard from their companions, if it's not younger men? And I think in my own life, I've seen different spiritual challenges attack me in different ways in different stages of my life. But not only do different enemies threaten the different stages of life, we can see different stages of Bible history that different types of enemy attacked at different times. In the very beginning of the history of the children of Israel, you see warnings against the Egyptian gods. For example, Joshua 24 and verse 14. But later when they came into the land of Israel, the danger became more the Canaanite gods and even the gods of Mesopotamia. Judges 2:12, they followed other gods from among the gods of the people who were all around them. And by the time of Jeremiah and Ezekiel, any idol within 500 miles was fair game for the Israelites. All idols from different parts of the world. When you come to the time after the Babylonian captivity, idols were not so much of a danger. The children of Israel had been cured of that open type of idolatry. But you see, in the time of Haggai and the time that they needed to be rebuilding the temple, the enemy was apathy, discouragement. And when Jesus came on the scene, you see him taking on the spiritual pride of the Pharisees. Different types of enemies threatened at different times. Now, none of these completely disappeared, but the threat represented by each one changed, waxed and waned according to different situations. In the early period of church history, the problem was Judaizing teacher. And you can see Paul taking them on in Galatians. But towards the end of Paul's life and towards the end of the first century, you see references to a kind of a budding Gnosticism that was becoming the big enemy. And of course, in the book of Revelation, you have persecution. So you see the point? Different types of enemies threaten more different stages of history. Briefly, and I'd like to study the history of brethren that we've known about, not necessarily the history of God's people. the brethren we've known about, and you can sense different types of enemies threatening more, different stages among known disciples. From 1800 to 1860, mainstream denominations were the big enemy. I was doing some research on my family, and I found that an old preacher influenced by Barton W. Stone, whose name was Rees Jones, he preached first to my ancestor, the Halls, in a place in northwest Georgia. And I, finding some articles about him, I found a description of his preaching. It said he had a warlike style of preaching because of the persecution at the hands of denominations. You know, which denominations persecute us today? But that was the enemy among known disciples perhaps before the Civil War. Later on, you see other enemies. Prosperity, and with prosperity, the desire to copy various religious movements around them. Then, as you see among brethren who maybe were successful in dealing with that somewhat, then you see the infighting and the fussing and fighting about various issues in the early part of the 20th century. After World War II, prosperity again begins to rear its head and affect the thinking of God's people, and a desire again to copy denominations, more infighting, worldliness. Of course, these are always dangers, but sometimes some dangers are more focused upon us than others. Well, that's the second fact about spiritual enemies. Now let's go to the third. Each point gets progressively longer. But don't worry, it's not going to be an hour either. Okay. Different generations often fear different enemies. And I think this is the fact that first came into my mind when I was starting to develop these thoughts. I identify mostly with my father's generation. And of course, the word, the number 40 there, you can say 40 or 50 or whatever. And I'm one of those Christians over 40, not by much. Well, maybe by a little bit. But Christians over 40 often fear things like this. Denominational error. I remember as a boy, most sermons I heard in gospel meetings were designed to combat mainstream denominational error, Calvinism, and things like that. That was the big enemy. I remember seeing my father have to deal with what we sometimes call institutionalism. Briefly, I think it's simply the concept that God's church is a network of congregations that should support the denominational machinery associated with the group. And what we sometimes call this package liberalism. In other words, the looseness with scriptural authority regarding the organization of local congregations, regarding worship, the work of the church, and of course, various, the desire to copy what we see in the mainstream around about us. Those were the enemies that I remember hearing about most of all as a young man. And I remember my father almost had to completely change his group of friends and associates in the 1950s and 1960s because he recognized these things, took a stand against them, and was ostracized by many of his old friends. Congregations where he used to preach would refuse to invite him back. And others, I know, suffered even more insults. Cut support, lost friendships in the battles over some of these things right here. I identify with that. I remember my father's anguish as he dealt with those things. And I want to take young people out and tell them, let's study institutionalism. What? You can see their eyes kind of glaze over. Oh, made that again. And sometimes I think if we're not careful, we can be tempted to say, well, they're just a bunch of convictionless millennials. We can use that as a kind of a nasty word, right? Why, they don't know what's right and they don't know what's wrong. But when you stop and think that way,
It's not that they don't have enemies, and maybe they could even be shown the errors of some of these things. They have their enemies, okay, but in their minds, other enemies are of a greater priority than those of us who are over 40 often have, or 50 or whichever you want. Christians under 40 years of age often fear an overemphasis on externals. And Phariseeism, an underemphasis on God's grace and mercy. I remember kind of in my grouchy old man, but grouchy young man mode, I guess, with a young disciple and all of these congregations with all their clapping and swaying to the music and shouting disorderly and just what's going to happen? The sky is falling. And then she listened to me sympathetically. Then she said, you know, they may be wrong. However, do you think that God thinks that that is worse than the cold congregations where lukewarm people sleepily go through the motions of worship as a kind of a dead routine, Sunday after Sunday? Well, which is worse? Clapping and swaying to the music, or dead routine Sunday after Sunday? Now, I don't think it has to be a false dichotomy. You can have orderly worship and enthusiastic worship. But as I thought about her question, I thought, you know, maybe that dead routine is even worse. And I think I have some Old Testament prophets that might back me up on that. But the thing is, as we were looking at enemies, I was looking at one set of enemies, and she was looking at another. Young disciples have often seen their older contemporaries fuss and fight over sending a check to some institution, and yet they don't pray. They don't study anything except for proof text to kind of back them up. If you ask them, what is the book of 2 Thessalonians about? They wouldn't be able to tell you. So that's the type of thing that concerns many disciples under 40 years. I'm going to illustrate this. There's a very popular evangelical writer, and his name is Francis Chang. He wrote this book called The Forgotten God. And several young people recommended it to me. Reversing Our Neglect of the Holy Spirit is the subtitle. And as I begin to read through it, yeah, there's some good points, but he thinks that the Spirit speaks to us apart from the Word. And he said he could not even rule out what was miraculous today. No. Well, what were they looking at? A powerful message against hypocrisy. And it is that. What was I looking at? Some dangerous postmodern influence, subjectivism, the idea that God speaks to us apart from the Word. And we were looking at the same book, just a different way of looking at it because we have different enemies in mind as we look at it. Another book he wrote is called Crazy Love, which has less objectionable material to me than others. But he's writing books. As we read this type of thing, let's learn to take the good, but be careful and know where they come from. As I think about it more and more, I sometimes think that maybe those of us who are older and those who are younger, maybe we're both right. Now, I don't want to sound postmodern. Listen to me out. But maybe we're both right. Maybe the things that we're concerned about and the things that they're concerned about, I'm saying we're, you can tell which generation I'm referring to. But maybe the things, they're all spiritual dangers. Isn't an overemphasis on externals and an underemphasis on the heart with that cold routine? Jesus fought against that more than anything else, perhaps. We'd better find a way to change our heart and worship from the heart, as I think we've been doing here during this meeting. But you and I know that it's not that way everywhere. We better find a way to get away from that materialism, which measures success in terms of dollars and stifles spirituality. We need to learn to pray from our hearts. But I'll defend us baby boomers too. You know, historically, the first signs of apostasy have to do with seeing the church as some kind of an organization rather than a family. And the denominational machinery of institutionalism leads people away from God and His simple ways. And the presumptuous attitude towards God's authority that says, I don't see any patterns anywhere. That's leading a people away from God, and they're just doing whatever they want to do. But they say it's from God because they feel good about it. That's wrong. But the bottom line is, when we're thinking of enemies, it's not either or. It's not either a cold routine or worry about correct doctrine. It's both. We've got to fight the overemphasis on externals, but also that lackadaisical attitude towards God's authority. They're both enemies. Well, let's go to our fourth point. And that is that the enemy that gets us is often the one we don't fear. And perhaps the best biblical example is in Numbers chapter 13. Here, the spies have gone into the land of Canaan, and they come back out, and we begin to see their report in verse 32. This is what the spies said. They gave the children of Israel a bad report of the land which they had spied out, saying, the land through which we have gone as spies is a land that devours its inhabitants, and all the people we saw in it are men of great stature. Then we saw the giants. The descendants of Anak came from the giants. And we were like grasshoppers in our own sight, and so we were in their sight. What did these spies fear? Those giants, those physical enemies. What should they have feared? Their own lack of faith. They were the enemy, not the giants. And that's the way we often are. We fear something. We have a perceived enemy. It's going to get you. But that's not what's going to get us. What's going to get us is something that we're not even taking into consideration. Quick illustration of that point. As many of you know, we've talked about it a little bit. We have a little camp there in New Jersey for a lot of the young people in the area. It's a personal project. It's not a work of the church. But each year we warn them about two dangerous animals. One is much more dangerous than the other. The first animal, there he is, the little bitty deer tick. But what he can do? He can give you Lyme's disease, a debilitating a disease that's much more prevalent in the Northeast than it is here. The second animal has, I used to say, never caused a death in the state of New Jersey. That changed last year. But anyway, it's not as dangerous as a deer tick. And, of course, that's the black bear. There are several of them out in the woods. I've had some encounters with them. But which one of these is the most dangerous? It's the deer tick. But which one causes fear and panic among the campers? Some of them. Some of them went chasing off after one year. But anyway. Generally, it's the black bear. So nobody worries about the tick. Everybody worries about the black bear, but one is more dangerous than the other. That's the way we are so often. We focus on what's not as dangerous as what actually gets us. Now I'm going to do this. This is a little bit dangerous. It involves some subjectivity. But I'm going to just give a list of 10 things that I think represent dangers to God's people today. And I'm going to start with number 10 and go down to number 1. And if you want to argue with me about my order, that's fine. That there's your dangers, you've got to. They're scriptural dangers.
But the order may be involve a little subjectivity. What are Satan's 10 most effective weapons against God's people? I've got number 10 is anti-religious scientific theories. Number 9, false religions. Number 8, that's party spirit among Christians that makes them take their focus off of God. Number 7, the spirit of presumption, that I just want to do whatever I can and I don't care about Bible authority. Number 6, postmodernism. You can't understand the Bible. Words have no meaning. It's all just some kind of a foggy thing out there that we can't grasp. Now we're getting to the top, my top 5. Materialism. The idea that money is somehow or another going to give us satisfaction. Comfortable Christianity. I think this is what Francis Chan takes on most effectively. Just kind of the routine, the comfortable routine, Sunday after Sunday. But don't ruffle me for anything else. That's an effective weapon of Satan. Worldliness that infiltrates our heart through our television, the movies, the entertainment culture. It twists people's minds as to what is truly worthwhile on this earth. Number 2 in my mind, lust of the flesh, pornography, that takes hold of so many young people and sometimes those who are older. And this is what I have number 1 on my list, is Satan's most effective weapons. Pride, selfishness. These are all companions. That's why I decided just to put them on one list. And, of course, the opposite of what accompanies that is a lack of love. If I'm thinking about myself and what I want, then I'm not going to love God and I'm not going to love His people. Spiritually, so often, we focus on one while another gets us. A couple of other illustrations. I work with a lot of really loving people from the Caribbean. And many of them, there's one sweet lady I remember who was about to buy a house. And she saw that some crazy teenagers had come in and painted 666 on the wall of the basement. She would not buy the house. It has the mark of the devil there. They feared demon possession. There was a number of years ago, stories out in the newspapers about some kind of weird animal. They call him chupacabras. It goes and sucks the blood out of goats. Boy, that really got everybody upset. So they fear those things. But what about taking marriage seriously? Sometimes they don't take marriage very seriously. What about the lust of the flesh? That's not feared very much. So you fear chupacabras and you don't fear lust of the flesh. That's what happens. And I think of brethren who fear instrumental music, who fear liberalism. I do too. But what gets them? Pride. Sectarian pride, carnality. And on the other hand, I know some brethren who fear this traditionalism, this Phariseeism, and what gets them? Pride, ungodly entertainment. I'm going to give a little side thing here since we're going to finish up pretty early, but I am scared to death about some of the movies that my brethren praise and brag on. Do you realize what you're praising? That can be a weakness. And some who complain most about hypocrisy have no fear of seeing some very ungodly movies with ungodly content. Looseness regarding clothing, materialism. They don't worry about that. Here's the thing. If we only focus on one danger or one type of danger or one family of dangers, the other's going to get us. It's all around us. We can't focus on just one group of dangers. The thing is, we have spiritual enemies beyond our comprehension. Paul, Ephesians 6:12. Against us, we have powers, rulers of darkness of this age, spiritual host of wickedness in the heavenly places. You think that we see our enemies in modern political battles, that's not where the enemy is. The enemy is beyond that, beyond our comprehension. In the heavenly spheres, don't ask me a lot of questions about hows and wherefores of Ephesians 6:12. I only know to say what it says, that our enemies go beyond this earth. And they were powerful enemies. But God has not left us defenseless. He's given us all the defenses that we need. As we go on reading, we read about the whole armor of God. And we can gird our waist with the truth, the breastplate of righteousness, the feet protected by the preparation of the gospel of peace, the shield of faith which God has given us, the sword of the Spirit, the Word of God, and prayer to our Heavenly Father. Yes, the enemies are strong, but God has given us everything that we need to take them on. But above all else, that love, that sincere love for God with all our heart, all our soul, all our mind. If we have that, we'll overcome. And of course, underneath that is loving our neighbors and our brethren with all of our being. We can overcome. We can win the victory. I've rejoiced in the songs that we've sung earlier about being a part of God's army and overcoming, not because of who we are, but because He has accepted us into His army. And we can triumph. We can have the victory. But if we start loving ourselves, start getting wrapped up in the world, we won't have it. May God help us to take on the enemy, not with our own armor, but with what God has given us. And that eternal life in heaven, which He promises to those who overcome, will be beyond our comprehension. May God help us to all be there, as we have dispensed with God's power with the enemies that have been set against us. Thanks for your good attention. If you're not a disciple of the Lord, you're facing the enemy by yourself, and you will lose. Every once in a while, I like to watch the nature documentaries, and occasionally you'll see some poor newborn antelope, and there comes the lion. There's no hope. The antelope can't do a thing. If you're without Christ, you're the antelope. Satan is the lion. Don't allow yourself to be in that situation for the enemies that are trying to destroy you. Take on the armor of God. Become a part of His kingdom. He will protect you. But you have to be in Him to be protected. Paul said in Romans 6:3-4, that the Romans had been buried with Christ in baptism and been raised up to walk in newness of life. You can be buried with Christ in baptism tonight and be raised up to walk in newness of life. Let us know if we can help you as we stand and sing.